Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We absolutely need to get better at sharing this stuff that is not, in many cases, classified, that is restricted for the wrong reasons. And we need a cultural mindset, which is AUKUS is a sacred cow and the rules that apply elsewhere don't apply to AUKUS countries because this is a top-tier partnership.
If we can't get this right with the US as a non-industrial competitor, then, you know, what are the potential chances of doing so with someone like Japan or Korea?
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm David Andrews. I'd like to acknowledge that we're recording on the land of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay my respects to their elders, past and present. Today I'm joined by two leading Australian experts to discuss Pillar 2 of the AUKUS partnership between Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States. Dr. Mia Hammond-Erry is the Director of the Emerging Technology Program at the United States Study Centre at the University of Sydney. And Ashley Townsend is a Senior Fellow for Indo-Pacific Security at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, David. Great to be here.
As I said in the introduction, and as it let's sort of get into it nice and promptly, we're here to talk about Pillar 2 of AUKUS. So obviously, the most high-profile aspect of the AUKUS agreement is Australia's planned acquisition of nuclear-powered submarines, which is generally referred to as Pillar 1 of the agreement. However, there's actually a second stream of effort, which has gone a little bit under the radar to date, and that's referred to as Pillar 2 of AUKUS. So perhaps starting with you, Mia, would you be able to explain for our audience what this Pillar 2 label refers to, what kind of projects are underway or proposed under the auspices of Pillar 2?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you alluded to, not as much is known about Pillar 2. And when it was announced in September 2021, it had six streams of what are known as advanced capabilities. So they were listed as quantum, artificial intelligence or AI, cyber, undersea, hypersonics and electronic warfare. Then in April 2022, the implementation briefing, expanded that out to include innovation and information sharing. So the innovation component was accelerating respective defence innovation enterprises, including ways to more rapidly integrate commercial tech to solving specific warfighting needs. And information sharing is a first priority, so enabling the other work streams to underpin the work of advanced capabilities. I mean, the short answer to this is that it's still a watch this space and there's a lot of progress kind of slated for 2023. I think despite widespread agreement about the significance of Pillar 2, really very little is actually known. You know, on the one hand, many of the capabilities are likely to remain secret due to their national security role. So we're not expecting regular or detailed updates. But on the other hand, you know, the stated goal is to trilaterally develop capability and engage with defence industry and academic partners. And I think to date, we've seen, I guess, fairly limited signs of that engagement. In terms of the, you know, the specific progress to date and the innovation front, the Albanese government promised to create the Australian Strategic Research Agency, or ASRA, to be modelled on US's DARPA. The UK now has the Advanced Research and Invention Agency, or ARIA, which has been established and is in the early stages of formation. I think they're still recruiting many positions. I note the initial ASRA consultations with academia and industry are underway from the Office of the Chief Defence Scientist. And the December 2022 AUKUS Defence Ministerial Joint Statement provided an update that was really largely reaffirming existing commitments and endorsing efforts to, I think they use the term, orient capability development to accelerate near-term delivery of technologies. So what that really looks like, I think, is that many things are still kind of in progress and we're expecting to see more. And as they put it, intensifying engagement in calendar year 2023.
Thanks very much for that. Is there anything you'd like to add, Ash? Does that sort of align with your read on the situation as well?
I think that's a great overview. And to shift a little bit to looking at the strategic and defense policy objectives when it comes to AUKUS Pillar 2, I'd make the following point. First, one of the reasons, I think, for the slower than ideal progress on developing co-development programs and work streams around the capability areas that Mia just outlined is because when AUKUS Pillar 2 was announced, it was not clear that all parties had exactly the same idea about what we wanted to get out of that that line of effort. For instance, from an Australian perspective, I think it's fairly clear that the Australian government and the Department of Defence specifically wants to drive capabilities of an advanced variety to the warfighter as quickly as possible. These are things like longer range strike capabilities in the form of hypersonics, other underwater capabilities that are autonomous and can supplement the Pillar 1 submarine program and supplement our existing Collins-class fleet, the integration of artificial intelligence into warfighting systems, combat systems, and so forth. These are the kinds of capabilities that could give Australia an asymmetric edge or the kind of asymmetric deterrence capabilities, among others, that the 2020 Defence Strategic Update outlined. A secondary objective for Australia is to build out a trilateral defence industrial technological base with the United Kingdom and the United States so as to set in place the conditions for the development of R&D partnerships that are seamless, and we'll talk about this later, but are not encumbered by restrictions with those two countries for future capability development. So in a sense, we're talking about a need to drive capability to the warfighter in the 0 to 5 year horizon and a need to reform the system of doing business with the Americans and the British for the future and for the maintenance of that pipeline of advanced capability going forward. So that's what Australia saw in Pillar 1, in Pillar 2 rather. But from the US and the British perspective, it did look a little different. From the British perspective, there was a lot more focus on the need to find areas where British industry and British defence industry is very competitive globally, could find projects of record to sell to the Australians and the Americans and co-develop with them as well. But it was much more of an industrial policy focus. And from the perspective of the United States, I think although Pillar 2 objectives were initially quite diffuse, it seemed to be more about finding ways to hoover up the niche advanced capability and R&D competencies that Australia and the UK had on offer and find ways to get them into the US defence industrial base more efficiently and more quickly than in the past, although that's aligned closely with Australia's secondary objective in terms of the way I outlined them, not in terms of their priority. The immediate need to drive capability from trilateral capability development to the warfighter from the US perspective was not front and center because the US defense industrial base is already doing that in its own way.
Yeah, Ash, 100%. And I would just kind of jump on the back of that and add that I think the need to bring together the three countries' defense industrial bases and work together more clearly, identifying, you know, sovereign and existing capabilities and then the potential to leverage new capabilities is really why information and technology sharing and that focus on innovation hubs, if you like, was brought on.
And I think that's exactly right. And just to add a point on the back of that, one of the important things to remember when we're looking at AUKUS Pillar 2 collaboration in this area is that this is one vehicle amongst many others that are out there. The UK, Australia, and the United States are all Five Eyes intelligence partners. They have the potential, with the right conditions in place, to also be exquisite sharers of unclassified non-defense technology and of classified defense technology if we can get the AUKUS settings right. But These are by no means the only avenues for any of the three AUKUS countries to pursue hypersonics development or the development with other countries of autonomous capabilities. We are doing these with other countries as well. AUKUS provides one pathway to do that at a high level of trust and confidence in information sharing, if that is what is designed. But there will be other lines of effort as well, particularly with the Japanese, with some European partners, and potentially leveraging the heft of India's emerging defence and technological industrial base.
Yeah, and I think it'll be really interesting to see how, Pillar 2 develops in the context, as you've just mentioned, the existing alliances and security pacts in the region, but then also the mechanisms, the new US national security and defence strategies, the forthcoming Australian Defence Strategic Review, and UK's kind of global Britain vision, and how these might fit in both as existing alliances, but what AUKUS Pillar 2 might bring uniquely in that context.
So I think that's a really fantastic overview both of Pillar 2, but also addresses I think why it matters for Australia and what it means for Australia. Because I think most people who, even as non-specialists, can grasp the importance or utility of a submarine. And some of the things in Pillar 2 can be, I think, somewhat can seem a bit esoteric sometimes or a bit intangible. And so I think that's been a really great way of contextualizing for our listeners and helping them understand why there is this parallel Pillar 2 set of efforts in such a wide range of fields and what the objectives are. However, just because we have great goals and great aims doesn't mean they're always going to succeed or run smoothly along the way. And so there are many complex challenges ahead in realising the objectives of AUKUS. I mean, perhaps especially in Pillar 1, given the complications regarding nuclear physics and engineering, but doesn't mean it's all smooth sailing in Pillar 2 at the time. So apart from the complexity in developing new cutting-edge capabilities, a big issue that's present in all technology transfer or military acquisition programs is that of export controls, and in this case, especially the United States' International Traffic in Arms Regulations, or ITAR. And Ash, I know this is something you've talked about before in other contexts, but and has also been discussed recently in the news by members of the US Congress in relation to AUKUS specifically. But would you say that these regulations are fit for purpose? Are they, do we need to seek sort of waivers or reforms to them to make sure that AUKUS can succeed?
No, the current export control regime in the United States is antiquated. It is not fit for purpose in an era of strategic competition, and it is certainly ill-equipped to implement the vision that is infused within the AUKUS Pillar 2, but also Pillar 1 objectives. And without changes in the way that the United States engages with and provides carve-outs and waivers for their engagement with Australia and the United Kingdom, AUKUS will limp along and not meet its objectives. This couldn't be a more important mission for the Working Group on Information Sharing, which works across both pillars, to get right. Just to rewind for a second, the United States export control regime for, as we know it, and the ITAR restrictions themselves were established in the 1970s. The United States was at the peak of its global technological prominence. It was by far and away the biggest spender on defense-oriented research and development, the most sophisticated technological power. It was at the peak of the Cold War as well, and the competition between the United States and the Soviet Union for technological prominence was also in its prime. The aim of ITAR restrictions was to limit the leakage of US exquisite technological know-how, and particularly as it pertains to weapons, globally, including to allies and partners, without a high degree, where there wasn't a high degree of confidence that information would be protected in order to maintain America's technological edge. But fast forward to the present, that mission, which made sense in the 1970s, makes no sense today, where the United States is one of many players on the global innovation game when it comes to R&D generally, when it comes to defense-oriented R&D and innovation.
The United States government no longer has a stranglehold on this. It's the corporate sector, it's Silicon Valley, it's the rest of the United States non-government ecosystem that is driving the advanced agenda. And allies like the United Kingdom, others in Europe, Australia, Japan, India, and so on, all have a lot of niche, high-end technology innovation, including increasingly, even for Australia, capability platforms themselves, like the Anduril XLAUV underwater autonomous vehicle, or the Boeing-developed Ghostbat autonomous air teaming system, that are things the United States military can and want to use, and things the United States industry want to integrate in their defense industrial base. So the ITAR restrictions that prevent that from happening in a seamless way are a problem for strategic competition in the 21st century. The efforts by the AUKUS working groups to negotiate a way for the three countries to share and work together in innovation and co-development, to not be restrained by restrictions on re-transfers and re-export authorities when a country like Australia wants to work with another partner country or another part of our domestic ecosystem on a co-developed capability or a bought capability from the United States, and so on and so forth. The efforts that AUKUS is proceeding to try and drive change in that agenda are encountering a lot of friction in the US system, friction particularly from the part of the US system in the State Department that is responsible for upholding that export control regime globally, and which is not yet convinced that there is a need for major change to the existing technology cooperation treaties between the United States and Britain and Australia, respectively, which already provide for some degree of waivers when it comes to export controls. This is not the first bite at the cherry. The 2017 expansion of the United States national technological and industrial base, which brought Britain and Australia in ostensibly into the United States' own definition of its defense technological industrial base, was designed by Congress to provide a pathway for Britain and Australia to be treated much more like the United States when it comes to defense industrial collaboration. That has not happened. The State Department's, the Congress's progress to date in implementing that arrangement has really come to close to zero, beyond the harmonization of information protection regimes amongst those three countries, has really come to zero when it comes to the issue of providing further exemptions that are wider and more expansive than what is already provided for in those treaties, and which have lower transaction costs because the paperwork associated with bringing to life the exemptions that are already granted in the two defense cooperation treaties are prohibitive for much of the Australian industry and even parts of the Australian government. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with a path forward now to convince the United States and the right actors in the State Department and in Congress that further reform is needed to lift the restrictions on countries like Australia and Britain, who are their partners in innovating for a strategic military edge in the 21st century, and to do that in a time frame while the political momentum and support for AUKUS in the White House and in Capitol Hill in the United States is still high enough to drive the kind of bureaucratic reform that's needed.
Yeah, actually, I'd just add to that. I mean, you're talking there about the premise, of ITAR essentially being tech dominance in the US. And I think one of the things that Pillar 2 has, which really separates it from sort of the traditional, if you like, defense industrial base, is that while some of the advanced capabilities, like hypersonics and much of undersea and electronic warfare sit really neatly in the defense bag, as you mentioned, cyber, quantum, and AI particularly, the challenges here is that the technical expertise and technologies of these capabilities reside in a diffuse set of largely commercial enterprises. And this regulatory framework is really needs kind of a rethink in terms of when you're looking at an alliance like this, collective resilience requires collective exchange. And it's really a different era and a different threat environment to be considering exchange on a more equal basis rather than on the presumption of individual technology dominance. And specifically, that many of those advanced capabilities, I think of areas in quantum, areas in undersea and artificial intelligence, where Australia does have a niche and quite bespoke area of excellence. So we actually have technology that the US might like. So that exchange needs to be two-way, whereas I think it's previously, largely been considered in a one-way context, which you mentioned. And I know you've done so much work on this at the centre as well as in other places.
No, I couldn't agree more with that, Mia. And just to add, footnote to what you just said, so much of the technologies that are restricted either by the Department of Commerce or in some cases even by the State Department that are commercially oriented are already out there. They've already leaked to US adversaries globally. In many cases, China itself has developed better versions of that technology and is leading the United States in some of these areas. So the entire notion that that the United States ought to continue to uphold a set of internally derived constraints on sharing commercial and military technologies with close allies like Australia that are at the same time moving further and faster to integrate with the United States to the point that we are hosting U.S. strategic bombers on Australian soil and talking about the extent to which we will support U.S. warfighting operations in the Indo-Pacific is quite bizarre. It's grating, and I think increasingly it's becoming a problem for the way that the U.S. and Australia can achieve their regional strategic objectives if we are spending so much of our time arguing over the details of sharing, in many instances, legacy technology with an ally at low compliance costs so that we can be empowered and be a better ally, a more capable ally in the region, and ideally a second source of supply and a additional source of defense industrial innovation and technological innovation for the benefit of the trilateral bit of AUKUS.
If I might just add a little sort of postscript. In a previous life, I worked in defence export controls in the Australian Department of Defence, which is the Australian touch point for these sort of issues. And one of the benefits, I suppose, is that we had a single point of contact being through the Defence Department. The UK has the Export Control Joint Unit, which is housed in their Trade Department, but it brings together people from the Foreign Office and Defence as well. But I think, as you both touched on in your remarks there, that it's not just that these diffuse technologies around private industry, but there's a diffuse range of US departments and points of contact from within their system, which can complicate and drag out the process, whether it's state, defense, commerce, or energy. And so sometimes you can be waiting years to get approval to export these goods. And as you said earlier, Ash, if we're looking at technology which can be delivered in the next sort of 1 to 5 years, then a 1 to 2 year ITAR delay means that those lack validity in some ways.
I was just going to say, I don't think this problem is unique to defence, though. I mean, emerging technologies have, to use an overused term, disrupted so many industries and existing legislative frameworks. So I think one of the challenges is that many of these capabilities are actually changing legislative frameworks across the board. So when you're proposing new legislation or regulation, you have to be conscious that that's coming at government from every angle, not just in this case defence, but also, in terms of privacy, in terms of the workforce, in terms of security, social harms. And so, decision makers are also overwhelmed with a very, very large, broad set of emerging technologies changing their landscape. And that makes it quite difficult to get the noise, to get through the noise and to get heard.
That's exactly right. And I think one of the points that is often raised when talking about the barriers to doing better in US-Australia defence industrial cooperation is a cultural mindset, particularly in the United States, which exists across the system in the departments, David, that you mentioned, which is to not share with even close allies and partners like Australia. At the end of the day, the desk officer in charge
of approving the reams of requests from US allies and partners globally, and there aren't enough of these desk officers, is responsible under ITAR for making the right or wrong decision and can be personally held accountable for making the wrong decision. So one of the objectives I think that exists behind AUKUS is to make it easier culturally, bureaucratically for that individual to know that when it comes to an AUKUS country, the default settings really is a yes, we'll share, and yes, we'll fast track, rather than a no, I need to cover my bacon so that I'm not going to put myself out of step with my department, these antiquated settings and the legal requirements that I'm duty bound to follow. Let's underscore the fact these requirements are critical. The United States should still be hypersensitive about sharing and diffusing technological know-how negligently globally to countries that oughtn't have them, to countries that are hostile to our interests. But when it comes to the AUKUS countries, I think the point that London and Canberra are making is that we do everything together. We work on the most exquisite platforms together, from the F-35 to the Pillar 1 nuclear-powered submarine. We absolutely need to get better at sharing this stuff that is not, in many cases, classified, that is restricted for the wrong reasons. And we need a cultural mindset across Commerce, State, the Department of Defense, which is AUKUS is a sacred cow, and the rules that apply elsewhere don't apply to AUKUS countries because this is a top tier partnership. I'll just make one observation of encouraging progress. If you look at the US system, although there are different parts, even of the Department of Defense, that are responsible for ticking off different defense industrial cooperation programs, broadly speaking, the DOD in the United States has really come on board in their support for Australia and British objectives in more seamless information sharing and export sharing between the two countries. Abraham Denmark, who was the special assistant to Secretary Austin in DOD, has a very wide mandate to grip up the entire department and get them on the same page when it comes to the AUKUS Pillar 2 and Pillar 1 objectives, but in this case, the export control settings that underpin the two of them. And the progress within DOD in terms of aligning bureaucratic duts has been visible. By contrast, the State Department and the Directorate of Defense Trade Controls within the State Department, which currently, as of last year, doesn't even have a director, is responsible for bringing the State Department into line with whatever reform agenda we have. They are the part of the system that has to oversee ITAR waivers and the lifting of ITAR restrictions. But they do not have a, if you like, Sherpa within the State Department responsible for this. They need one. They do not have the same kind of cultural mindset that the DoD has. The DoD, which is steeped in close collaboration in war zones with Australia in the way the State Department is not. And so bringing that system together, David, to your point about a single point of contact, is really critical if we're going to get AUKUS progress.
Yeah, absolutely. Ash, I was just going to add to that, I think export controls really have the potential to hold up this integration agenda. And if we can't get this right with the US as a non-industrial competitor, then, you know, what are the potential chances of doing so with someone like Japan or Korea?
We'll be right back.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
One aspect of Pillar 2 in particular, which has been discussed both by Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles and in the Quad Leaders statement of last year, about looking at avenues for using Pillar 2 of AUKUS as a means of expanding the group. of bringing in other countries, potentially Japan. The US Deputy Secretary of State has also flagged New Zealand in other remarks. There's other, I suppose, Five Eyes countries to varying degrees of technological capability, but Japan is the one that's going to be at the top of the list for most people. So I'd be interested in your sense on whether that's realistic, whether that's wise, or whether that's something that would happen in the short term, or perhaps that's more of an aspirational goal for the future.
Yeah, look, I think it makes sense to explore technology collaboration wherever possible. I guess the question here is whether that occurs under the auspices of AUKUS, specifically Pillar 2, or in another form. I guess I want to bring in some recent polling here by the United States Studies Center, and I can get you the link in the show notes. And it underlined increasing popular support for Japan-Australia security ties and trilateral Japan-Australia-US alliance. Significantly large majorities of the US, Australia and Japanese publics at 70% or more support collaborating with allies on issues around emerging technologies. Across all three nations, only 3 to 6% express any reservations about collaborating on emerging technologies like AI, quantum and semiconductor manufacturing. So that's a huge level of support, obviously. Those questions don't specifically relate to AUKUS. So when we did break down the AUKUS questions, when it comes to the expansion of the AUKUS partnership, American support for adding Japan to the agreement was largely bipartisan and sat at about 55%. Australians were greatly supportive of including Japan at 62%, a move seen to have potential in addressing gaps regarding defence production capacity in the US, Australia and the UK. Contrarily, Japanese respondents tepidly agree with the notion of expanding AUKUS to include Japan. So 39% agree, 24% did not agree or disagree, and 6% disagree, with almost 30% saying they simply didn't know. So, I mean, in terms of public sentiment, there seems to be sort of mixed sentiment, but broadly, support for an alliance of some type with less specific support for AUKUS. We are seeing strong signs of that support expanding out, obviously, as you mentioned, specifically in relation to Japan. I think I would note the DPM's, speech in Tokyo in December 2022, where he did say, we need to get to a point where AUKUS is delivering. And when it's delivering, I think there's an opportunity to involve Japan. There's clearly a real need for this to work, and reducing any blockages like the ITAR issues is going to be key to making any potential broadening of that alliance. I note that up until very recently, whilst there's been discussion of Australia, Japan and US agreement, there's been limited commentary from the UK. And obviously as a trilateral security agreement, it would need UK support. And a few days ago, the chair of the UK's Defence Select Committee suggested the AUKUS agreement could expand out to include both India and Japan. I'd like to hear Ash's view on this, but I think there are a number of challenges with expanding out. As I mentioned, the defence industrial base in Australia is a non-competitor. So from that perspective, we're looking very much at leveraging each other's capabilities. Given we haven't seen a huge level of progress on Pillar 2 as yet, and there's definitely scope to be made in industry and academic consultation, as well as broadening down the working groups and starting to deliver. I know there's some exercises in undersea and quantum, but more broadly than that, I guess actually delivering those capabilities, you really want to have a successful alliance framework to be able to move to expanding the scope of that.
Yeah, I think, Mia, that I agree with everything you've just laid out there, and I'd add a few extra comments. I mean, first, I think just going right back, the broad requirement of US allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific, indeed globally right now, is to find ways to collectively innovate, collectively pull their industrial capabilities, their R&D sectors, their capacity for innovation, but also their capacity for collective military action in regional theatres in order to deter and dissuade the challenges presented to those two regional orders in Europe and Asia by competitors Russia and China, competitors which themselves are big enough to take on the existing status quo in both of those regions. So that requires a whole range of things, but it's in that context that I think the discussion about defense industrial integration and technological integration is required. And indeed, this is an ongoing conversation, as I mentioned before. It goes back to 2017. It goes further back than that even, where efforts in the United States to bring Britain and Australia into the US defense industrial base really hit the agenda through the NTIB expansion. So there is a need for heft, for bulk, for leveraging also the private sectors and incentivizing the private sectors, including the venture capital and equity markets in those countries to invest in defense products, to invest in innovation that can be for export, that can be trilateral in nature and so forth. So in that regard, I am very supportive of the agenda of the ambition over time to bring other trusted partners into the AUKUS framework. Having said that, as you say, Mia, the settings, and as the DPM said, AUKUS needs to be delivering before that can happen. I probably wouldn't use the word delivering myself. AUKUS should be delivering in an ongoing way. But the governance frameworks around export controls, information sharing, co-development, the right to re-export, re-transfer authorities, etc., that whole bundle of issues needs to be resolved amongst the three AUKUS partners currently before we can bring others into the field. And the reason for that is that when we do bring Japan or France or Germany into collaboration with the AUKUS 3 on, let's say, a particular capability area under Pillar 2, those countries are, all of them, much more likely to be industrial competitors, certainly for the United States and Britain, and therefore lower the threshold of the appetite in those countries to make it easier for the three AUKUS countries to share at sort of low transaction costs. Bottom line, there is an issue here of aligning the autarkic commercial objectives of all of the countries involved with the collective objectives in a strategic policy sense of all of the countries involved. And that balance is very delicate. I do think that AUKUS has done itself a disservice by having such a prominent acronym, because it implies that anyone that joins AUKUS is joining this whole bundle of activities, when in reality, the AUKUS 3 will be the hub of the arrangements. And when it comes to, say, hypersonics, where we might want to work with the Japanese, or when it comes to underwater capabilities, where we might want to work with the French and so on and so forth, we'll be plugging those countries in once the settings are right on just one or two areas. They're not going to be joining open slather the AUKUS arrangement. And indeed, AUKUS itself, most importantly, it hasn't yet been said in this podcast, is not an alliance. It's not about strategic policy objectives. It's not about any kind of action in the Indo-Pacific or anywhere. It is a defense, industrial, and technological partnership. It is one that is trying to build a new model for that kind of exchange, and it's one that I think needs to welcome in others when the time is right. A final point on that, and that is that when it comes to which countries we bring in and when, I think you do need to look at the different incentives amongst the three AUKUS countries. For the United States, for example, as I mentioned at the beginning, one of their goals is to access and use and work with the advanced technologies that are being developed and the innovation ecosystems that exist globally in other trusted countries. So although they may have reservations about, let's say, Japan joining a certain program, until Japan's information resilience, cyber resilience meets certain criteria, and there have been concerns of that nature in the past. They also apply to the RAK. They apply to some parts of Europe. They do want to work with the high-end industrial and technological sectors in those partner countries, in those allied countries. For Australia, again, going back to the most important thing to get out of AUKUS, it is capability in the short term. It is capability for the ADF that can be fielded in the 0-5 and an ongoing way of doing business
with the Americans and the British to generate that advanced edge in a sustained way over time. It is not clear that Australia's objectives are best served by quickly adding another country to the AUKUS arrangement until those, you know, getting those settings right are more important. At the same time, Australia has its own programs of defense industrial cooperation with Japan, with France, with India, and so forth. And indeed, some of those lines of effort may prove over time to be to pay dividends more quickly or in different ways than working through the AUKUS arrangement. The nature of the restrictive export control regime in the United States may end up meaning that for a particular capability area, it makes more sense to work with India and the heft that its industrial base can bring at low costs for the development of attributable long-range capabilities. It may be that over time, it makes sense to partner with Japan, a country that's also highly integrated into US combat systems when it comes to what it develops in ways that can, where we can co-develop hypersonics or other underwater capabilities with the Japanese more quickly and maybe with less baggage than trying to do it through some of the AUKUS arrangements. And indeed, as we are doing at the moment, we're pursuing multiple lines of efforts in some of these capability areas already. AUKUS has touted underwater capabilities as an area of early delivery for Pillar 2 progress. At the same time, the Royal Australian Navy is working with Anduril Technologies to build a low-cost, ITAR-free XLAUV underwater autonomous submarine, which it hopes to field within 2 years from now, and which in some ways is in a race with what is being developed in AUKUS in order to provide an option to government more quickly. It may well be the case that there are options that are coming from multiple places, multiple partnerships, multiple different kinds of institutional arrangements, and AUKUS is one of them. So maintaining a degree of competition from Canberra's perspective across those different defence industrial collaboration lines of effort may prove to be in our advantage over time. It may give us a degree of leverage when it comes to AUKUS negotiations, and it may give us a safer approach that doesn't put all of our eggs in one basket. And I think that's where we are. We're in a safe approach at the moment to the development of advanced capabilities that the ADF so urgently needs.
I think certainly from my perspective as someone who is doing a PhD on multilateral security institutions and alliances and these kind of relationships, I think I always default to a walk before you run approach to these kind of arrangements. And I think for those reasons you've both explained and for a whole range more, I think I'm certainly in agreement that there's plenty more to be delivered and to be finalized before we look to bringing in all and sundry into the wider expanded sort of AUKUS arrangements. And did you have anything further to add on that point there?
No, I just wanted to thank Ash for bringing it back to the focus on the defence security component. And I guess I just wanted to highlight that, like many areas of emerging technology, the capabilities here are critical to defence, but so many of them are fundamental to broader society. And this is really where sort of many tensions are bubbling up. These technologies are critical for our digital landscape, for communications, for, you know, weather assessment, for remote sensing, functions of civil society. And now we're seeing they play a key role in economic and political power of states. So we are trying to bring many capabilities that are critical across society more broadly and integrate them into a very complex, defence regulatory framework and get some of these technologies in the hands of warfighters. And I think that really will be the success of AUKUS Pillar 2, is managing to establish that framework so we could in the future broaden it out to additional alliances. So thanks for that reminder, Ash.
Couldn't agree more.
Well, I think that's just about as much time as we have for today. But thank you both very much for your time, for your contributions and your great insights here. And we hope to work with you at National Security College again in the future. So thank you, Dr. Mia Hamidery and Ashley Townsend.
Thanks, David.
Thanks very much. Thanks, David.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.